ンベア青春。ウェルカム It is now time for SDF Open VoIP Please dial 1088 to join the conversation.
Welcome to the SDF conferencing system. One other party is in this conference.
Hello.
オープンボイプ1088。
Commodore is not menacing. Commodore makes all the little children happy.Mara being Salamat.
Open VoIP 1088.
Is there anyone there?No one can hear me. Hello?
There are two other parties in this conference.
Hello? Hello, shy people.I should think of a story. Let's see. Well, I've been making some pancakes. I have, oh Lord, what is it? It's some kind of Indian, flour. It's not very good, but I like it.
There are two other parties in this conference.
Hello, this is Jazz Maz.
Hello, Jazz Maz. How are you tonight?
Doing well. How are you?
Not too bad. Just trying to finish off my pancakes.
Half your pancakes,
They didn't come out so well. They kind of broke in half.
Yeah, they sometimes tend to do that. Usually the first one out of the pan is the worst casualty.
Yeah, so I don't have much skill, but I enjoy it. Homemade and with lots of whole wheat.
Open VoIP 1088.
That's probably part of the problem as well, that sometimes the whole wheat recipes don't hold together all that well.
Yes, but it's ever so good for you.
Oh, yeah, it's absolutely better for you than, you know...highly processed white flour.
Did you know that for centuries, people preferred it white? Isn't that strange?
Mm-hmm.
Like, only the poor people could have the wheat.
Yeah.
Kind of backwards. Can you hear me all right?
Yeah, I can hear you just fine.
It's not too low.
No, it's quite loud, actually. I was thinking about turning down the, I don't think it's you that's too loud. I think it's just my, whatever I have my ATA set to and the phone I'm on tonight.
Well, I noticed that the 1088, the server has, the AF is a little loud.
Mm-hmm.
It's a little louder than usual.
Yeah, it's possible that SMJ may have changed something. I imagine that on the conference bridge, that since it has to, unless everyone's coming in on the same codec, probably has to decode and re-encode, basically transcode everyone's signal, and then they probably have the option to increase the gain software-wise.
That's true. But probably, I changed my codec off the last time. So I'm using, what's it called? The GSM. I think it was GSM. You recommended it.
Well, I think it supports it. I think I was using it at one point in time when I was traveling on an Amtrak train and using the train's Wi-Fi.
I see.
Someone recommended it to me for a lower bandwidth codec.
Yes, I was using some much higher bandwidths before. The 44, what is it? Something 44. Yes, GSM.
Yeah.
Looking at JW8. Funky Me is feeding a tortoise in his backyard.
What is that? Oh, Froggy Me is feeding. Okay, I see that in calm now. Yes, Froggy Me is feeding
calm.
Is it actually a tortoise? And
it is. I think so. Snowy, you should join us. A froggy is feeding a tortoise, and that's very funny. No, I don't. Oh. Snowy is eating dinner. What's new in Jasmat's land?
Nothing really new. Just work and miscellaneous other trying to get things together for the Vintage Computer Festival Midwest. I saw on comm earlier today that Froggy Me and SMJ seem to be coordinating to ship out the SDF's AT&T 605 terminal, so hopefully that will arrive and be part of the display, or be the centerpiece of the display.
Does SDF have quite a big collection?
I don't know. You'd have to ask SMJ and other people who have maybe inherited equipment over the years whether they still have it or not. I know SDF's been operating long enough that it has sort of been on a fairly diverse bit of hardware over the years.
Oh, yeah, I should think so. Well, I know they have the Freebie 2.
Right.
I'm wondering if they're going to take that to, where is it, Chicago?
No, I don't think the plan is, I think his original plan was to ship the 3B2 to the East show because some of the, some of the original developers were there and, he thought it would be a cool idea. But I think logistically, the terminal is probably easier for him to send in some cases, and more interactive part of it. In Midwest,
all you need is a terminal.
Right, in Midwest, there would be people there that would definitely recognize and appreciate the 3B2. There are a lot of techie people at that show that would know exactly what it is. And in fact, there are some, in past shows, there have been some 3B2 hardware on display.
Yes.
Not sure of what specific models off the top of my head, but I've seen a few. But also the other issue, too, that's convenient for him, I would suspect, or SMJ, I should say, rather than him, to be clear, probably having the 3B2 at the Living Computer Museums, Living Computers Museum and Labs. I never get the pearl in the right place. it's probably easier for him to deal with if something goes wrong or has to be corrected on the 3B2 than if he had to do it remotely at some unknown, you know, where the network is largely unknown to him.
How many of the festivals are there? Is it just the three?
No, there's more than that. I think there is East, West, Southeast, and Midwest. And then I think there is also a European show as well that is I don't remember if they're, you know, managed within the Vintage Computer Federation, which is sort of the new body organization for most of the shows. The Midwest show is independent. But there's a lot of overlap. There are a lot of people that attend other, you know, the East show or the West show that show up at the Midwest one as well.
That's quite a lot, actually.
Yeah. But, you know, you figure the U.S. is kind of physically large, so having a couple of them scattered across the continental United States is probably not a bad idea. It probably permits more people to attend one of these shows. Like, I don't think there are a ton of people from, like, the West Coast that are going to come to the Midwest show, but there might be a few people from the East Coast that will.
Have you ever been? Is it very well attended?
The Midwest show is very well attended. It's been growing every year. It's I forget how much floor space we're up to now, but last year it was packed tight, so we changed venue this year. And I guess the other shows are pretty large too because they're
open
VoIP
1088.
But I'm not sure how much of the floor space they can take over without, you know, sort of having logistical problems with the permanent exhibits. I've never been to the East or the West show. I've been to the Computer History Museum, but not during any sort of event.
Is the Western one always in Seattle?
I forgot Pacific Northwest. I'm dumb. So there's a Pacific Northwest one that is in Seattle specifically. The West one historically was in the San Francisco Bay Area. In the last number of years since it was revived, it's more specifically at the Computer History Museum.
Getting those two confused. Living History Museum.
There's the Computer History Museum, which is in Mountain View, California, which is in the Silicon Valley area, and then there is the Living Computers Museum and Labs, which is in Seattle, which I think was founded by one of the Microsoft founders. I think that's Paul Allen.
No, really.
Yeah.
Well, I think it's nice that they get on the road. There's so many people in the Midwest who probably can't go to all the way to the West Coast anyway. So.
Yeah, sometimes it's difficult. It depends. Like I was actually considering going to the Pacific Northwest show back in the spring, but it just didn't quite work out for me scheduling and budget-wise.
But yes, that's the budget is really the thing.
But I think SMJ announced the date of the next Pacific Northwest show, which is in late March. Let me look at the calendar real quick. I think he had said it was the 21st and 22nd or 28th and 29th. I forgot. It's one of those two weekends already. So.
In comms, Snowdesk is talking about that. I don't understand. Who's Kiko?
Don't know.
I probably have to
scroll back a little bit. So Snowdesk says, I remember La Tortuga from the Breaking Bad series.
They're talking about the tortoise still. La Tortuga.
Oh. I think they're talking about Filipino children's programming. Okay, that's a whole other world, I'm sure.
We're quite off the topic. Well, that sounds fun. I like Sesame Street.
I'm going to set my phone down for a second. I'm going to go run and get my coffee, and I'll be right back.
Good stuff. ¿Cómo está, Snowy? ¿Cómo está? I've exhausted all my Filipino, I'm afraid. Now, what is La Tortuga? I know that means the turtle or the tortoise.
Okay, I'm back.
Well, I can't Google that, actually, Snowy.
Sorry to hijack the VoIP with other com banter. I don't think that's such a big deal.
It's very hard for me to to watch the discussion on com and then also to talk.
Sometimes I ignore it myself, but every once in a while I'll glance at it and scroll back and maybe comment.
Oh, La Tortuga is the alias of a gang leader. Well, yes, I'm afraid I haven't seen that yet. I'm not very into crime stories, so procedurals, they call them. Not very into them. Although I do like Sherlock Holmes.
Yeah, but that's not exactly a typical crime drama.
But it's more intellectual, isn't it? I like to go to this festival. I have to look it up.
Do
they have the PDPs?
There will usually be a bunch of PDPs. Some semi-complete, and some front panel stuff. There's a couple of guys that are sort of doing like modern panels or replacement panels or attaching old panels to modern single board computers and things like that, just to make them kind of work, and emulators to make them usable, even if you don't have the complete machine.
Yes, I saw a video on that on YouTube. There was a chap who, trying to remember where he was. He had an IBM 360, mm-hmm. I think it was, blinking light display.
Sure.
And the problem was that all the lights had broken or fallen out. So he tried to use some LEDs, but they didn't have the same
electrical characteristics and illumination, right?
It wasn't the illumination. He was trying to get the look and feel from the outside more than the verisimilitude on the inside. He did something. He had to electronically make the LEDs work. But he accomplished it, and it was quite impressive. It very well may have been that festival.
It's possible it could be other people, other places, too. I know there's a lot of collectors out there, and they're all kind of doing their own little restoration projects.
Have you been following the, the Apollo Guidance Computer?
Yes.
Group. Have you followed that?
I haven't followed it directly, but I've, you know, obviously because of the anniversary, a lot of information is kind of trickled forth. And also there was a little bit of a presentation on, I guess, a guy that was re-implementing, I think, an emulation and so forth and so on, the Apollo Guidance Computer that I guess they have released.
Hello and welcome. It is now time for SDF Open VoIP. Freeze Dial 1088 to join the conveyor station.
Yes, there's an entire series on YouTube shot by the men who did it. Mm-hmm. It's quite impressive. I haven't caught up in the past 2 months, I think. But it's well worth digging up.
Oh, Exile mentioned there's a comic convention at the festival, too. So,
oh, good show.
So let me talk a little bit about the history of the current Vintage Computer Festival Midwest. So before it became a combined show, the Chicago area Classic Computer Show was, in fact, originally just a Commodore 8-bit computer show that has its origin back in an old Commodore users group. And it kind of evolved since then. The original Vintage Computer Festival Midwest was originally held at Purdue University in Indiana for the first, I think, 3 or 4 years, and then it went on a hiatus, and then the Chicago area folks picked it up, and we eventually kind of tagged along on the Commodore Expo since they had space, had extra space where they were, and it was just easier to do that, and then it's become sort of its own little gigantic thing as well. So there's still a very big Commodore presence at the Vintage Computer Festival Midwest, but there's also a pretty diverse amount of things that want to be there, too.
Oh, I see. Do they do any demos? Like, do they have a competition?
I don't know that there is a demo scene competition that ever goes on in response, you know, in conjunction with that show. But there are people there are a subset of people from the Commodore side of the show that were and I guess still are in some capacity part of the demo scene, Commodore and otherwise.
No, that's something I'm really interested in. But I don't have any skills.
Yeah, that you have to kind of learn a little bit how to abuse the hardware to get it to do things that are more interesting.
Yeah,
yes, Block Party. That was originally, wasn't Block Party originally set up with, Froggy mentioned Block Party.
Oh, yeah.
Wasn't that set up with the, what is the name of the show that I'm trying to think of right now? No, I think Block Party is separate. I think I'm getting it confused. But I was thinking that there was a kind of classic slash modern demo scene thing that was created out of the Nauticon community technology slash hacker conference that happened in the Cleveland area a number of years back. But I think I'm getting that confused. It might have been maybe at party or something else may have come from that.
At party. No, I don't know that.
I don't know if that's still going on, if that's a thing either anymore. That used to be, I think there was, I can't even remember. I'd have to actually go and look.
Open VoIP 1088.
Well, I've been very interested in how vibrant and big the Commodore scene is, actually.
Yeah, well, considering how many units were sold and, you know, it doesn't really shock me that much that, you know, it's going to be a certain percentage of people that are going to always kind of still have an interest in early technology that they kind of started with.
Mm-hmm.
But since Commodore sold so many units, I can see why their retro computer groups tend to still exist, even after all this time, in pretty significant numbers.
Well, it's good for me. It's the budget. I don't need much.
Yeah.
Not too expensive.
No, that's the other thing about, like, it's not terribly expensive yet to get your hands on a used Commodore 64 because so many of them were made, or even a VIC-20 for that matter. Quite a lot of those were made as well, but sometimes your VIC-20s have issues, but most of their hardware can be still found.
Oh, yes. Hello, who's that?
Yo, DJ Hardmouse, what's up?
Hey, Hardmouse, how's it going?
Oh, Hardmouse is on. Very light.
Oh, I see in comm that you're I'm going to get an Apple IIgs and a Timex Sinclair soon, huh?
Yeah, I had a Timex Sinclair, and I never really used it a whole lot, but...
Well, there's a reason for that, I'm sure.
Yeah, I mean, they were like doorstops for a lot of
They were tiny and membrane keyboards, so they were okay if you had access to nothing else, but...
Right. I don't know, they're kind of neat little toys, honestly.
Yeah, I've got a pair of TS-1000s that a friend of mine gave me that I have in storage, along with some memory expansion and a whole bunch of data books.
Nice. What's funny is it came with the memory expansion pack, which I forget what it was, like, I want to say 16K, but that's generous. But in the manual, I wish I still had it, man. I lost it, but the manual says something about, you know, you can use up to 16K, not that you would ever need to.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, the whole industry is littered with statements similar to that, you know, like the, you know, CPM people are like, you know, if you can't do it in 64K, you can never do it at all, right?
Right, right. Bill Gates.
What's the difference between the 2E and the 2GS?
Quite a bit. The 2GS moves to a 16-bit 6502-derived processor.
Okay.
I think they are using, did they use a Ricoh version of that CPU, or was it actually Western Design Center? I don't remember off the top of my head. I could probably Google it. Froggy Me also mentions memory. Yeah, a lot more memory available to it.
Really?
And then, of course, it has enhanced graphics and sound.
So how did they accomplish that, if it's a 6502?
So they basically extended the register set and the address bus.
Just like an REU.
Yeah, well, REU is more like virtually paged memory. The memory in the REU doesn't actually isn't actually processor direct.
Right.
It's all transferred in a DMA cycle typically.
Right, I remember that.
So this actually increases the register sizes of the CPU. It's basically a whole re-engineered version of the 6502 with, you know, 16-bit instruction sets, 16-bit registers, and I forget how wide the actual address bus is off the top of my head. I want to say it's capable of addressing like 16 megabytes of RAM.
Which is really about as much as a Commodore 64 can do virtually, at least, right? It has a cap of 16 megs.
Yeah, well, the REUs have a register set in them that, in theory, you could hang 16 megabytes of memory off of it.
Mm.
Typically, one or two was the typical, you know, hacked expansion.
Yes. You really don't need more than that. Well, interesting. Tell us about it, the 2GS.
Go ahead. DJ Hardmouse, if you have some information, further information about the 2GS. I'm not an expert in any means.
I know it was like, I want to say it was after the 2E. The 2E was sort of their big flagship, and I really don't know anything about Apples or Macs, but I remember the 2GS, you know, using it as a kid. And it was geared toward gaming, but also education. I think it was one of the first ones to have, like, a mouse and a modem and that kind of thing.
Oh.
I could be wrong on that.
And then I think the history is, too, that Apple Recording Studio sued
OpenVoIP 1088.
Apple Computer over the audio system, that was the audio chips that were in the 2GS, and that's why the Macintoshes didn't actually have any sort of, you know, hardware-based music generation in them by default.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Yeah, the sound was, it was kind of PC speaker tier, if I remember.
Yeah, it was all, you know, you needed either, like, third-party expansion if you wanted to do quality audio out of an early Macintosh.
It's just pure nostalgia for me, honestly. They're just kind of, it seems to be, like, easy to find parts for them in decent condition as well.
Well, that's good to know. Mine's been behaving pretty well. Whenever I use mine, sadly, mainly for, you know, transferring data, since it, you know, is basically a platform where I can find Apple Macintosh disk, you know, models of disk drives that work on the Macintoshes and Apple on the Apple 2GS to kind of move data around, or at least that's what I did before there were other more convenient methods of doing it.
I found something cool. I'm just kind of digging around, you know, eBay, looking at old computer stuff, you know. And this is a vintage Wang 4230A computer terminal. I guess for like a mainframe, it looks like.
Sure.
Oh, wow.
Mainframe or mini or you know, even to sit off a terminal, you know, one of many to sit off some type of terminal multiplexer.
I don't know why everyone wants to... Oh, I'm sorry. Go ahead, dear.
Well, I was going to ask you if you plan to program anything, what were you going to do with your 2ETS?
Probably just play games, to be honest.
Just play games. That's good enough.
I don't know. It depends. If you can add some kind of networking card to it...
Yeah, I think there are some networking cards available for it. I don't remember off the top of my head, but I imagine you could probably find someone that's done the terrible Crystal Logic Ethernet controller solution for the Apple II stuff.
Oh, nice.
I mean, it's cool that it exists, but it's kind of a horror show to program, especially on a 8-bit machine. But on a 16-bit machine, it would be much more usable. Because in 8-bit mode, it loses its ability to process interrupts.
Oh.
That makes sense. Less.
So it becomes largely a polling device, which is kind of difficult. Makes things difficult if you're trying to do anything high data rate with it.
Makes sense.
So with a 6502, The assembly should be just about the same as a Commodore, right?
To some degree, that, you know, the buses have compatibility. Obviously, like the Crystal Logic, there is an equivalent Ethernet controller, and it was originally part of an add-on card to the Retro Replay cartridge. There was an RR plus
right.
Net card that used the Crystal Logic chip. For an Ethernet controller. A hardware developer named Jim Brain made a cost-reduced version called the C64 NIC Plus. That didn't require, you know, it was just a straight cartridge. It didn't require the retro replay card.
Jim Brain has done so much for Commodore.
Mm-hmm.
I see his name everywhere.
Yep, well, I mean, the Quantum Link software, he wrote most of that. Quantum Link Reloaded, I shouldn't say Quantum Link. He wrote most of that. He's done all sorts of hardware projects. I think the thing that he's responsible for the TCP SER program. I remember when he did that because he was trying to get the Modem Wars game for the C64 to run over the internet.
Modem Wars?
Yes. So this was a two-player modem networked sort of game, just sort of a tactical combat game, move-based, but you would dial from one computer to another computer using your modems, and you basically play a two-player game across the telephone network with it.
Like Battleship.
Something like that.
Warcraft, oh, that sounds fun.
Warcraft, Warcraft 2, all that stuff.
Warcraft, yes.
Yeah.
Oh. So much to make a port for a Commodore, for Warcraft. That would be funny. Well, I've seen they have Ultima. They have the old Ultimas on Commodore that are still used.
Yeah, those were great. They were on a lot of things. They were on Apple IIe. I remember a friend of mine had it on Apple IIe. Ultima 4.
I have a friend who still runs a Shard on Ultima Online.
Oh, really? That's pretty cool.
Froggy Me, who do you think gave a talk at VCF West 2016 or 2017?
I think he means Jim Brain.
Oh, Jim Brain. Yeah, that's quite possible.
Open VoIP 1088.
Oh, Spy vs. Spy. Yes, it's famous.
I didn't know you could play Spy vs. Spy over the modem. Which for what platform?
Yes, the Quantum Link.
Commodore? Oh, didn't know that.
Commodore, yeah.
Oh, okay. Yeah, I do remember that on Commodore. And NES, I remember.
Yeah, I remember Spy vs. Spy on the Commie, but I never knew that it was a two-player modem playable game. That's interesting. I'll have to play with that. Yeah, Froggy Me, Quantum Link Reloaded Guy, that's probably Jim Brain then, or possibly Glenn, a.k.a. Shadow M, or Senbi, perhaps, because he was running the main instance for a while, and he was giving a number of talks to try and get people interested in continuing to develop it. Quantum Link is more than a BBS, technically speaking.
Oh, yeah.
It is an online service specifically targeted for the Commodore 64, but later had other incarnations. You might have known some of them as PC Link, Apple Link, and then eventually America Online. So it is sort of the predecessor to the evil that was America Online.
I find it quite endearing.
Copy,
not America Online, but Quantum Link.
Yeah. And then, of course, the Quantum Link was based on a software system called PlayNet, which was originally supposed to be a network playable kind of game.
Minnesota. Who did that?
What, PlayNet or Quantum?
Yes.
I don't remember the specific origin of PlayNet. I'd have to probably look that up.
It was a state project, if I recall correctly.
It may have been. I know some of the Videotech stuff was certainly.
The Videotech, yes. I'm a fan of NAPLIPS, so I'm always looking for NAPLIPS, Videotech sort of things. Well, are people showing up to Quantum Link lately to the Wednesday night? I think it's Wednesday night.
It's been kind of slow the last number of weeks. I think I've mentioned this to other people that it just might be the summer months that Wednesday night
at
8 o'clock Eastern Daylight Time might not be a good time for it. I should
probably
query people and see if we want to try a different one. But I guess we're getting ready to switch time zones soon anyway, so.
Oh, I hate that.
Like
to stay with UTC. Sorry, hard mouth, you're ever so light. I can't really hear you.
Sorry, hang on.
No, it's SIP seems to have a very strange
Check
very
1, 2.
Curve. Oh, that's
yeah, you're better
awesome.
Now.
Okay, cool. I don't have my good mic. I don't have my condenser mic hooked up because my
Hello
my
and
AC
welcome.
Is insanely
it is now
loud.
Time for SDF open void. Please dial
88
to join the conversation.
Well, right?
Oh, it'd be horrible. And I got so much echo in here. So I'm just using this cheapo headset mic.
Whatever works.
There are 4 other parties in this conference.
Oh, someone new. Hello, newbie.
Oh, hello. I'm talking to you on my Neumann something microphone.
Sweet.
Today I'm trying out a AT&T, or actually it's technically Lucent branded trim line phone that followed me home from a thrift store this weekend.
Wow. What color?
I need to get me a real phone.
It is originally, I don't remember what the original colors were, but it was sort of a beige or cream color. But the ultraviolet radiation from the sun has sort of had its way with it to some degree.
Yellow.
Yeah, so it's a little yellowy, especially from a very specific angle.
I'm just using a boring 2500 set I've been using for a while.
I'm using a very chunky one myself.
Tell us about it.
I have no idea. It's a generic that I was given actually by my company for my phone years ago. And it never has worked on my phone, but now it works on my iOS for this. So, good thing I didn't throw it away.
How are you? What exactly are you doing? You're tethering
open VoIP 1088.
No, I have it's a headset.
Oh,
and,
I see.
Yes, it's like an old. I'm trying to remember the difference. It's the other one, the Motorola or Nokia, I think it was, standard for the plug. The RTA, I think it's called, plug.
Okay.
It's the one that needs an adapter now for all phones today.
Well, it sounds fine.
Yes, Snowdesk says I want to use the butt set, and that's true. I wish I could.
Right. Yes.
Yes, if it works, it works. A clutch is a clutch. No, I'm not kidding, Snowdesk. I would love to use the butt set.
So do your clips still work on that? Do you still have all the cabling?
The clips work, and I've tested it. I hooked it up. I cracked open my, don't tell anyone, I cracked open my landline junction box, and it does work. But the caps are all dead, so I'll either have to replace the caps and maybe some of the microphone.
Yeah, so the microphone preamp in it, if there is one, is dead, probably, right?
Yes, but it's an old Nortel. It's an old Northern Telecom. It's the green one. If you look on eBay or something, you can probably find it. It's green, and it looks like a regular phone of the 1960s. So it's very space-age looking. It doesn't look like a regular
phone. Now, the question, is it actually green, or is it really a pale blue, and it's turned green with time?
Now it's an OD green. It's all drab.
Okay.
And it's very retro looking and very cool, and I'd love to keep the wheelie, the rotary. Yes, I love it.
Okay.
I've found some instructions to do that, convert it so you can use rotary with DTMF, so I think that's what I'm going to do.
Oh, nice. I didn't know you could do that.
No, yes, it doesn't take much. You keep the rotary
So do you have the one that has it? It kind of looks like a trimline handset without a base.
Oh yes.
Oh
right.
Okay. It's got the dial in the middle.
Yes. Isn't it lovely?
Okay.
With a little, it has like a red pot in the middle.
I gotcha. Okay. Yeah. I'm looking at one of those. Does it have
it has a hand.
Is a little monitor button too that so you don't have to, or is that just a switch?
It's just a switch. It's a hang-up switch. And that's about it. That's all it has. But it's delightful.
So one of the coolest jobs I had was pulling cable for a PBS.
Attention and on radio listeners. Coming up at 0300 hours UTC is a Penmic with open mic. Anyone can stream.
He picked up all his AT&T customers and put them under contract. So I got to work with him, but I was like, the lowly cable puller and doing the 66 punch down stuff and everything like that. But my dad gave me his Budinski, and so it's like a 1976 Western Electric blue one with the rotary dial on the back.
Oh, right.
And the cool thing about that is it has a monitor button, so you can either like clip on to a pair and then engage, and then you have the line, or you can just monitor a line. And so it became quite useful for doing stuff. I still have it, actually. Because, I had to do, when I was working for Ted's company, I had to do, I managed the lines for the pots. I didn't, I guess I did part of the install, but the modem stuff. So, but they had a lot of issues with ring through. So I would have to go through, and I'd have to figure out which modems had to be reset and which modems were trashed, and that I made a lot of use out of that Budinski. So I am very fond of analog telephone pairs.
Well, it seems to be a common interest here.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
I was never good with telephony, all the punch-down blocks and all that stuff.
But it takes a special kind of intelligence. You really have to listen very well, don't you?
Yeah.
I guess so.
The other thing I'd like is a butt set that has DTMF, but has the, what's it called? The A, B, C, and D tones.
You're talking about Autovan?
Autovan, yes, thank you.
Yeah, priority.
Right.
Yeah, it's an additional frequency that gets in that DTMF matrix, and it's basically just one extra frequency, but
But they're like 500 hertz higher than the other frequencies, if I recall. They're a very strange frequency distribution on DTMF.
Yeah, but it's pretty easy to track down what it sounds like, and it's not that, once you hear it, it just makes sense, and it's not any more unusual. I think
Open
Boy
the multi-frequency 1088.
Tones are a little more interesting, but on that Autovan pad, the priority pad, all you're doing is there's four different levels, or actually, I guess it's not three different levels of priority. I think it's just Or four, I think it's three, and then there's one other, action thing. I never used Autovan, but...
No.
Yeah.
Let's hope it never had to be. I remember one of them was straight to the Capcom or the
supposedly. Right, supposedly.
Right. It's supposed to go straight to President or something.
The multi-freq frequencies for inter-office communication, like for tandem office and stuff like that, is a different set of frequencies. So it's much more unusual because everybody's sort of familiar with DTMF. They've heard it so many times. And then, with their modems, auto-dialing, or telephone numbers, you kind of start memorizing telephone numbers by DTMF, things like that. But multi-freq is its own thing.
Is that sequential or is it parallel? Do the tones come in one after another, like in the radio ALE?
I think I have to think about that. I think they are two frequencies, so it's
at the same
sort
time.
It's sort of like a DTMF idea, but they're just different frequencies.
Interesting.
And part of the reason why they're different frequencies is that, for a while, they were in band, on the trunk, and that's kind of like that was the gateway for phone freaks to control the switching system using these tones and using their little boxes.
Attention and on radio listeners, coming up at 0300 hours UTC is a pendant with open mic. Anyone can stream.
Right, and you'd hear them right over the line anyway. So when you call 1088, that's multi-freak. That's not DTMF.
Oh, really?
Using consumer handset. Yeah, that's all it is. It's just playing like it's making a connection to another office, basically.
I will have to research that. So this was used by businesses, or?
No, it was inside the switching centers in the central office.
Yeah. I did not know that.
So they go, it could be either within the central office, between offices, because each switch is considered an office, and you could have several offices within a central office, or you could have offices that specifically routed calls rather than handled end subscribers. So you could have one switch that would use another switch to then get out to several different central offices. It's really fascinating that what is it called? Universal service. Sorry, the mandate of the federal government that the Bell system was to develop universal service so that we could do coast to coast dialing, things like that. Yeah. And then after they accomplished it, you know, break them up. So
it was kind of a miracle, wasn't it, to be able to, even rural people had this eventually.
Right, yeah. I mean, I'm sure there's still pockets. I mean, I heard, like, and maybe there still are more stories like this, but... like in the late 90s when Verizon purchased GTE, there were still electromechanical offices way out in rural places.
And
and supposedly like in 1998 or 99, you could go to this shack somewhere in Indiana and, you know, stick a microphone under the door and you'd hear all of the Stroger step collectors going. but apparently, and you used to be able to call, in fact, it almost became a nuisance thing. You could call, I think it's, I'll find out the name of that town, but you used to be able to call the post office, and you'd be able to, the post office got so many calls that they started, you know, considering it nuisance calls, because you could hear the selectors actually ka-chunking while you were on the line.
Oh, wow.
Like, call the post office.
So people would call them just to hear that.
Yes, exactly.
So they became telephony tourists, and much
yeah.
to the post office.
Yeah.
I don't see how that hurts them at all.
Yeah, Indiana. I want to find this.
Well, near my house, there's one of the last... AT&T payphones.
Okay.
The ones that you can, that were so popular for a national and international freaking back in the day.
Okay, the red box stuff.
Right. Okay. And I tried to red box it actually. But no, I did.
You openly admit that? Okay.
Well, okay. I mean, sure, but you know, just putting the tones in, I recorded them on my cell phone, but it didn't do anything. So I'm pretty sure that the
Open
local,
VoIP 1088.
Company is all that switched over to VoIP anyway. So.
Or something.
Oh, well.
Yeah, the when I call in from the AT&T payphone at the Living Computers Museum, if I drop quarters into it or any coins into it, you can hear the red or the
right.
the cone
yes,
tone. That'll
right.
come across.
That red box.
Right, it's very faint, but this one still has it.
I see.
Must be faint.
Yeah, you hear them. You'll hear them in the handset. Right.
Right. Yes. And it has that old headset to the handset that you could unscrew on the bottom.
Oh gosh.
Yeah, you put a phone tip in it.
It wasn't glued?
No, it's very ancient. It's a relic. I'll have to upload a picture eventually.
Oh, LaPorte. That's what
attention and on radio listeners. Coming up at 0300 hours UTC is a Penmic with open mic. Anyone can stream.
Was the last Roger that was decommissioned, and I think it was decommissioned in 98 or 99.
Yeah, that's too bad.
But I heard stories, because of people going out there and stuffing microphones under the door to record it, and apparently it made really sickly sounds, because it was such disrepair.
Oh, poor thing.
Yeah.
That makes me sad. I'm sure they just threw it away, too.
Could have been. Yeah. Oh, I know that a lot of electromechanical stuff just got, thrown out.
That's horrible.
Yeah, but, they made so much of it.
Well, now, a Northern Radio used to broadcast a show, like a retrospective or documentary series by some FDFers who were freaks back in the day. But I haven't heard
Phantom
it in a while.
Freak.
Do you know who they are? Sorry.
The King and 9X.
9X, was it? Really?
The, no, those are just, God, I can't remember the guy's name. Sorry.
Captain Crunch.
But they were very educational.
No, it's not Captain Crunch.
Captain Crunch was awesome, man.
Oh, I love him.
Was he?
Yeah, he found
Enjoy
a...
bubbles.
He found a whistle in his Captain Crunch
right.
cereal that emitted 2,600 hertz and let him get into trunk lines.
Was it Captain Crunch? Was it really?
Yeah.
Oh, my goodness. Wow. No, I mean on the
fame.
Show.
No, the one is Evan Dorval. That's who it is. And those are just Evan Dorval used to go and travel around and collect recordings. So he had a field recorder, a reel-to-reel tape recorder, and he would use an inductor microphone, the little suction cup one, and then put it on the handset and go and dial various switches and waste a lot of time, and maybe not so many quarters or dimes, few dimes, just recording all this great stuff. So
wonderful.
Yeah, those stories are still in the non-radio thing, and they just come up every once.
Yeah, they every once in a while will just play.
On a spindle.
I have a story about Captain Crunch, though. I met him.
Oh, wow.
I met him a couple of times.
No way. That's awesome.
Well, there's a picture of him and some SDF users. I'll get that for you as I tell you the story. So,
Dude's a pimp.
Yeah. Let's see. Curiosity. I think it was VCF6. Maybe it's
I just think it's funny that Captain Crunch cereal just stuffed a blue box inside as a prize.
Well, what they did, what it was, is it was just enough within the threshold of the 2600 hertz that it could be used. If you blew it just the right way, you could get the tone that would seize the trunk.
Yeah, and my guess that if I remember the whistle correctly, it was intended to really be kind of more like a steamboat whistle kind of sound.
Yeah.
No doubt.
But I mean, it was enough to filter and seize the trunk, and then from there, then you could start sending digits. So that's what 2600 hertz does. Otherwise, you won't break dial tone.
But now they eliminated that very quickly, didn't they? I think it was the 70s.
Yeah, it was pretty quick. So my father was working for Bell Labs at the time, and he was on what's called the electronic key telephone switch project, which was to replace the key telephone project. You know, that thing you would see in schools or a doctor's office or whatever with all the little lighted plastic buttons. Those were electromechanical, so the EKTS project was to use a microprocessor to then not do digital voice or anything like that, but do digital switching with analog voice. And the first, there was something called a horizon, but there was also the dimension. And my dad was working on the dimension, and the default password...
そろそろこの番組は、
ああ、違います。